good. This roundtable discussion involves three of us, three people, sorry. This roundtable discussion involves three people. Peter MacDonald, who is here at Christchurch, is the head of the... Do you want to talk a little bit about your work here?
Just briefly? Well, what I do here, Michael, is I'm a tutor in English here. I'm also the director of a thing called Tower Poetry, which has existed for about 15 years. And I'm also a professor of British and Irish poetry in the University of Oxford. So there are several hats on my head.
Very good. Once. And William Wooten, who's made his way up from Bristol today, and William is a poet and critic and teaches at the University of Bristol. Do you want to say a little bit about what you're up to?
Well, I've just published a book on the Alvarez generation, which is the poetry world in the 60s and moving into the 70s. And I suppose I framed some of my views of the present scene by referring back, not always. And that's been my most recent critical venture. But I do try to keep up with what people are doing now and make sure that my narrative isn't always a declinist one.
Well, William's book on the Alvarez generation is a very interesting one because it is that generation out of which the magazine that we're celebrating, PN Review, Peter's giving the first PN Review lecture to mark the relaunch of that magazine. It's out of that Alvarez generation and, in a sense, against it that PN Review emerged. And I started it when I was at Oxford and continued it into my later times in Manchester. It is now 42 years old, and so we're celebrating this very round anniversary with a lecture, but we also redesign and a reorientation. And Peter's lecture, which William and I have had the opportunity to pre-read, raises lots of issues with which both of us, I think, agree, and also lots of issues on which we very differently differ. And if I could just start by saying that what struck me is there are two protagonists here. One protagonist is Yeats, who, as it were, leads the discussion, and the other protagonist is Heaney, a very different kind of poet with a different kind of relationship to the poetry establishment and indeed to the academic establishment, which seems so bent on displacing the poetry establishment at the moment. I wonder, William, what did you feel? Did you feel that the kinds of negotiation that Peter suggests Heaney's work and Yeats's work differently conduct with the establishment contrasts in a way that's useful?
Yes, they certainly do differ. I think you're right that Heaney is a model of a partially successful negotiation between a poet of considerable standing and the academy, and while one can find problems with it, it does suggest that it need not always end in quarrelling. There might be terms perhaps between quarrel and consensus, like discussion or debate, which have a little bit more mutual ground and to and fro.
You do speak, Peter, of consensual discussion, and I agree with you that there is considerable consensual discussion. There's also quite a lot of disagreement about. And one thing that worried me about the example of Heaney, perhaps, is that, and of other poets who enter into arrangements, if you like, or into treaties with the academy, is when does consensus become collusion, and when is there a mutual collusion between the academy and the poet?
Yeah, I think still the whole question, though, of Heaney's placing his self-placing and then his reception in relation to the academy is a rather a complicated one. It's certainly a long one, and I think in truth it's got to be traced back really to the 1960s. That is almost to the beginning of the professional poetic career for Seamus Heaney. We also need to differentiate probably between the Academy in the United States and what we're calling the Academy in Britain, Ireland, and Europe, I guess. As to consensus, Seamus was, of course, a master of talking through and with a consensus. So masterful that one would never notice the consensus was there. This one must translate into terms that are often used, warm, human, friendly. Now, the fact that Seamus himself was all three of those things, and abundantly so, shouldn't allow us to necessarily take his critical positions and say that those two are warm, human, and friendly, when in fact they may be conveniently locating him as a poet in regard to academic matters. But this question of consensus and the Academy seems to me in many ways a difficult one, and one where there's cause to worry. I believe even Heaney's work, if you look at it carefully enough through to the later years, begins to worry about the way in which poetry is processed by an academic cultural establishment.
Does it also begin to write for that establishment? In a sense, there are certain strategies to which establishment strategies of the consensual kind you write about, they look for certain things, and if they find it, they clap their hands and say, "We have found it." And eureka, whereas in fact there may well be a bit of construction going on there that has not got the rapture that you might expect from a...
But one point I'd want to make is that on a fundamental issue, which was consensual and uncontentious in the 1970s, that is the issue of what a poetic canon might be, Seamus Heaney's work is sure of its feet. It knows exactly where it stands in relation to questions of canonicity. It is essentially a canon that comes out of the Academy of the 1950s and a little later. That seems to me to have vanished. And Heaney, in fact, if he were now taught seriously in many academic contexts, would be more challenging than he was when he was alive. He is plainly a critic, for example, who thinks that some poetry is better than other poetry, that some poets are not to be ignored, that if you find, I don't know, Milton a little bit difficult, it's no good saying that I found a poet publishing last week who's really much more fun, and that will do. Heaney is quite clear that that will not do. It seems to me that's the voice of an older academic establishment, which now seems out of place and out of date. This is not to the credit of the Academy.
He was also always looking to the past, and he was looking abroad, so that the kind of canon that he aspired to belong to included Joseph Brodsky, it included Darren Walcott and Les Murray and so on, a point usefully but possibly excessively made by certain critics at the time. Coming back to this notion of communal discussion, though, William, consensual discussion, how consensual is it, do you think? You come from Cambridge.
Well, initially, yes, we were talking about that before, but certainly when I was an undergraduate, there was, and still is, there's a collection of poets that get called the Cambridge School by everyone but themselves, and it is a matter of faith not to be the Cambridge School if you are in the Cambridge School. And by the very fact I've said that, I will annoy people who would say to mention that the Cambridge School is a strategy and a dismissive one. But that had, and I think still does, its own canon of modern poets. Its traditional canon, this canon before 1900, is remarkably similar to other people's. It might rate Wordsworth even more highly than he's rated elsewhere.
And
Swinburne, certainly, if you were Veronica Forrest Thompson, probably not if you were Prynne. I think Prynne is interested in Swinburne, but only in the way that Pound is interested in Swinburne. It's always difficult to speak for someone else, and I'm sure he has his own views that he can put on record. But certainly, yes, the poet critic Veronica Forrest Thompson was very keen on Swinburne and reclaimed Swinburne. And then in the 20th century, someone who would be completely canonical for Seamus Heaney, like Edward Thomas, might as well never have existed. 20th century poetry begins with Pound, really, and Eliot, but to a lesser extent. And modernism has not stopped. It continues. Now, that is a position that would be contended by many poets in, not just here in Oxford, but in St Andrews or in Liverpool. So there certainly isn't consensus there. There may be consensus among a certain number of people in Cambridge, mm-hmm. but that isn't a general consensus.
It always struck me, I had very limited experience at Cambridge. I taught there for about 3 years, but it struck me at the time that the poet who might as well never have existed was the most important one of all, and that is W.B. Yeats. And interestingly, there was common ground there between what you're calling the Cambridge school and indeed people, very, very eminent traditional critics like Christopher Ricks, who would make rather straight-faced claim that Yeats was somehow not good enough. A claim that's still occasionally made, though I think it sounds to me increasingly quaint and parochially English when it's made.
Yes, well, that's partly to do with sound, that I think Yeats is thought of as being too sonorous, and I think that's ultimately a Leavisite position. Prynne partly does come out of Leavis. There are many paths out of Leavis, and one path is the path taken by Jeremy Prynne. Yeah. And there is a distrust of sonorous, a distrust in some ways, the things that give a lot of people pleasure about poetry.
I suppose it kind of, just to butter it in a little, it does come down to a very fundamental fault line, which is to do whether poetry grows out of pleasure or out of the working and terribly clever imagination.
But also, Peter, in your lecture, your lecture does center on Yeats, and you do talk a lot about Yeats's rhetoric, and I think I think as a reader, I resist the rhetoric, and certainly the poets who stand behind PN Review, one of them, Donald Davey, was a great Yeatsian, also a great Poundian, and was alert to the rhetoric issue. C.H. Sisson, who was probably my great guru, grew very, very impatient of Yeats, and it was precisely the rhetorical Yeats, and so where all the ladders start in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart, is of course a rhetorical construct, not an example of a sudden fundamental change of perspective on Yeats's part. Among the writers of the 50s and 60s out of which PN Review grew, there was no consensual position. And that was a very healthy thing, I think. I don't think they would necessarily have taken seriously at all the ruminations of professors, even of Professor Ricks. They would listen to one another. Debbie S. Graham would listen to Sisson, Sisson would listen to David Wright would listen to Dylan Thomas or whatever. But there was a very strong resistance to the notion of the institutionalizing of the study of contemporary poetry. Of course, there's always a place for the study of earlier poetry. And the transformation that's occurred in the 40-odd years in which PN Review has been at work is a pretty thoroughgoing one, isn't it? I mean, which poets still stand outside that charm circle and still, as it were, lob their poems into it with the expectation that it may disrupt?
I wonder whether this category of this distinction between the inside and the outside is altogether feasible. As with everything else, it depends what we mean. Increasingly, it seems to me that the charmed circle if we call it, it's an interesting metaphor. Mm. It's a metaphor that maybe takes us to the tempest or somewhere, in which case somebody's being Prospero, has to is defined by exclusion. I suppose I would say that the more announced plurality you have within that charmed circle, the more efficient it is at excluding. this is a difficult
why
subject.
Is that? Explain that paradox. I mean,
it is to do with consensus. It is to do with the fact that, let us say that everybody inside the charmed circle rejoices to concur that they are tremendously plural and that there are no rules to getting into this charmed circle, apart from the people who aren't in it. But we don't mention them and we don't listen to them. Now, this is probably... what I'm describing here may well have nothing to do with poetry and everything to do with institutional structure and power.
Well, the exclusions that are, as it were, being made right now, people like W.S. Graham, for example, people possibly like George Barker, the new exclusions include people who, to my generation, were very important and who contributed a lot to PN Review, Tony Harrison. Or indeed, Geoffrey Hill, who, oddly enough, is in a position... we all love his work, and to my mind, he's probably the great living English poet, but how many people read him? And you raise the issue of pleasure. I get tremendous pleasure from Hill, but it's a pleasure that comes from instruction and from a kind of... not training is not the right word, a kind of passionate involvement in reading around him, through him, etc. The notion of pleasure worries me. As a kind of starting point, it's surely a point of arrival.
Geoffrey Hill has always been an interesting one because he both is and is not of the of the establishment. He is the most lauded poet of his generation, so but the claims that he is neglected don't entirely stack up. And
how many poetry prizes has he won?
Well, he has turned down some and not allowed himself to be entered into some.
I'm thinking of those British poetry prizes over the last 20 years where his volumes have been neglected entirely, even from the shortlists, never mind the winning positions. And I fear if we were to go back over all those shortlists, we perhaps wouldn't be as delighted as we might have been at the time with the genius and originality on show there.
I think that is a good point about which Geoffrey was manifestly well aware.
But isn't what you're talking about again, this cultural, this consensual discussion, is geared to awards? It's geared to the kinds of recognition that you would expect to be given to prize livestock. And the fact is that Geoffrey Hill is difficult to read, and it's easy to read Caroline Duffy. She'll always have a bigger readership than Geoffrey Hill, which does not, I think, actually tell us anything about the relative quality of the two poets. And therefore, I think this notion of standards, which I know, Peter, you've often argued about and been attacked for arguing about, is really quite a crucial one. Mm-hmm. If we are in an age of prizes and of market leaders and so on, to actually cherish the art itself, which doesn't necessarily happen in the marketplace, says he as a publisher.
Well, no, I see no reason to think that the prizes matter in the sense of promoting the production of new art. I think they probably don't. But they matter, of course, in a way that's utterly unconnected with art. They matter, for example, if a poet's first or second collection manages to get shortlisted for one of them, then she or he will, in the British world, and I think in the American Academy too, be at an automatic advantage when it comes to signing on the dotted line for a tenured position. So professional power and the meat market are connected. And I don't worry about that at all from the point of view of poetry. I don't think it stops any good poetry being written at all. I do think it's worrying in what you might call a social sense, which is that we seem increasingly to be educating young people in the creative end of literature, and especially poetry at the expense of the difficult end, the head work of reading a great deal of sometimes recalcitrant material from a past that is going to be more or less alien.
You don't believe then that, whereas the market can corrupt, we know that, if you write a bestseller, you imitate yourself and write another bestseller or try to. You don't think that if you get a position in a university and you find that certain things go and certain things work in that connection, you move up, you become a professor in some distinguished institution, you don't believe that in fact you begin to write for that alternate market, which is the academic market?
I suspect that there are instances of just that. I suspect they are more on the other side of the Atlantic than this one.
I disagree strongly. I think that there is a corruption that comes from writing for an academic audience as well as a corruption that writing for a popular audience. And in some ways, I'm happier with the notion of a popular audience, an audience outside the academy, which at least corrupts openly and isn't associated with the promotion of virtue. Mm. And I have worries, even with poets whom I otherwise admire, I think there is a sort of vanity about writing for an academic audience. And I do have slight problems with the trajectory of Leyte Hill, because I think he has written for more and more for his admirers, and I'm not sure that that is so different from a popular poet writing for his or her admirers. And this doesn't mean that I don't greatly admire a lot, even the particular work by Hill, but I don't think it isn't a problem. And if you're talking about the health and consensuses, I think it's the worry that you don't raise about prizes and the academy is neglecting a larger readership, and a readership worth having. Mm. And there doesn't have to be. I would like there to be a larger readership that is informed and is capable of discerning reading, and that for that reason, I have problems with writing for ideal readers who are postgraduate readers.
But we were talking earlier about that amazing review that Edward Thomas, not an academic, but a journalist and a travel writer and so on, as well as a poet, wrote of the first books of Pound. And Lassell's Abercrombie was furious with him for doing so, in which he said, we do not have a language for talking about this amazing work that Mr. Pound is writing. He says he writes as though Shakespeare had not written in the language, which he saw as an enrichment, not an impoverishment, because he was obviously aware of Shakespeare, but that he was doing something that was semantically very different. So as though he was writing from Latin or from French or Provençal. And there's this wonderful sense of a reader who is responding to something he can't get his language around. And he's urging other readers to come and let's talk about it. Let's read it. Let's get this strange pleasure for which we don't have a language. We can't paraphrase our pleasure. Which he's, to my mind, the ideal reader. He's not your fisherman going off in a Yeatsian with his Yeatsian rod, but the man who reads a lot of poetry, or the woman who reads a lot of poetry, and is suddenly surprised and excited by something he finds there.
It's worth, just as a rider to that, noticing that a couple of weeks later, Edward Thomas
retracts
back on the review.
Yes, well, he was forced to, because his bread was being buttered on the Georgian side, as it were.
Yeah. Of course, the ideal reader does take you back to Yeats and the fisherman goes out at dawn to cast his flies, as we're told in that extraordinary poem. Though the ideal reader for Yeats, and I suspect for a number of lesser poets of a similar vintage indeed to Yeats, the ideal reader did not necessarily exist because was not necessarily placed in the present. And I take completely the weight of what Will is saying about that recalcitrant and sometimes barren world of Late Hill, which is then unexpectedly relieved by moments of extraordinary lyric beauty. But of course it may be that Hill is writing for readers who have not been born. Now you can read that as an act of extraordinary intellectual presumption or moral foolishness, but it is a choice that ultimately will link him to Yeats. You see, one subtext, I think, of that lecture that I'm giving is that Yeats's time in a way has not yet come. That I think we're still learning how to read Yeats. He is not in the past at all. Now, this is a counterintuitive thing for a literary critic to be saying. And yet it is, I think, how poets and writers work. Their sense of time and sequence is scrambled because that's what poetry does.
Well, their time comes round at last, doesn't it? I mean, Donne's time comes round a bit later than we might have expected. The issue for me is I don't know of any writers that I profoundly admire, which includes Edward Thomas, and indeed, to some extent, Hill in the same way, who are writing for readers. I mean, a readership is an abstraction. An act of writing a poem is an act of great particularity. And to my mind, the imagination's prints as well, I mean, are particularist. And as soon as a particularist starts, as it were, casting his particulars towards a generalized audience, something very funny happens. I don't know how many... I mean, when you write a poem, you, Peter, you almost always choose a traditional form, which means you're already in conversation with other poems in the past. What you're writing is fitting into a very large and wonderful structure. It's going to find its place in a large treasure house, which may sound passive, but it's not. It's a resource, and it's a democratic resource. I can't imagine you sitting there thinking, I'm going to write this for my third year, or for my three graduate students. No, you're not thinking of readership. You're thinking of a place in a longer tradition.
I'm not commenting on what Peter thinks about it, or most poets in the right now, but I still think that some poets are affected by the sort of reading that goes on around them, their expectations, their last reviews, who they've been talking to. If you go back, say, to the American poetry of the 1950s, one gets a very strong sense that the new criticism, which was the the dominant mode of criticism at the time, was affecting the way poems were being written.
Absolutely, but when you think of Stevens and you think of Moore, Stevens doesn't give public readings. As far as I know, Marion Moore very seldom did. They're writing. That's what they're doing. They're writing an oeuvre. They're aware of their earlier stuff. They're aware of their later stuff. They revise in the light of what they're doing. To me, it seems that as soon as you start responding to your audience or to your critical audience, you begin probably, especially if you're successful as a performance or in performance, not as a performance poet, you begin to do what Lowell did when he began to perform his poems on the West Coast. You begin to simplify your diction, or you begin, if there's a Latin tag, you translate it. And gradually the texture of your poetry is affected. Now, in Lowell's case, it wasn't entirely a bad thing that it was affected. But on the other hand, it was, and maybe it was just part of the process of his development, but I always feel that there was a kind of compromise in relation to audience rather than to readership going on there, which in some deep way damaged him, and it made his earlier work somehow unstable. He thought, I must go back and revise all that because it's not quite getting through to these folk.
Yeah. I think that new criticism and the mid-20th century for American poets is a very pregnant moment, really. And the question is whether there are any lessons that can be transferred from that moment to, let's say, our own. I'm not entirely sure that there are. Do we, for example, have any particular critical, academic way of reading poetry that could be formulated or particularized quite as much as new criticism could have been at the time? not sure that we do. Or if we do, I think the news is not good. That is, what the message is, don't judge. Let a thousand flowers bloom. But then, and this is not in accordance with that, the message is also, be an identity. Write for a community. Now, these seem to me big, fuzzy things, not the particulars of the well-wrought urn or whatever you want to look at that could produce the Quaker graveyard at Nantucket. These are notions that belong somewhere other than art, I think, and yet artists, to make partly because it is in their material interests to do so in relation to the Academy, accept them. I'm only saying here what I've been saying for many, many years. My second critical book was entitled Mistaken Identities, and was about Northern Irish poetry. As far as I know, it did not a blind bit of good, because identity or identitarian thinking seems to me much more powerful now than it was then. Curiously, it's a bit weaker in Northern Ireland, but it spread like a virus through Scotland to Anglo-England, everywhere. I do think that artists need to fight extraordinarily shy of both identity and community. But no one... That is unsayable. I know I'm saying it, but it is unsayable now.
One thing we had in the 50s and 60s, and I was, as a child educated in the United States, had it, was the famous anthology, the Brooks and Warren anthology, Understanding Poetry. And I think almost all the poets of my generation were passed that way and either rebelled against it or colluded with it. But what that anthology did was suggest that there are not great poets, but there's a huge... Well, there were, I suppose, 100 poets in that book, I suppose. And that all of them had something to say. So suddenly poetry became a much less hierarchical, much less restrictive space to move into, which was both a good and probably a very weakening thing. There was a toolkit. There were ways of reading, which meant that there were ways of writing. And I think it's people like Richard Eberhardt and so on, even, MacLeish and so on, were wonderfully enabled by this, because we could all read their poems and say, ah, yes, beauty is truth, truth, beauty, and we knew exactly what they meant. You know.
Yes, well, minor poets can be very useful to poets, so that you can construct something different from what's gone before. For example, I don't think Sidney Keyes is a very good poet. Geoffrey Hill, more from Sidney Keyes than he has from all number of canonical poets. And so it's not a bad thing if people read and enjoy minor poets. That doesn't necessarily mean that that everybody else should think these minor poets are great poets.
Well, I think it's David Wheatley, actually, and amongst our contemporaries, who's engaged in what he calls the quest for the perfect minor poet. And there are quite a lot of good candidates there. But of course, minor major is really academics talk. I don't think in the real world, which I define as the world of art, it means very much. Let's say, for example, if we're talking about W.B. Yeats and the figures standing behind him, his Sidney Keyes, well, perhaps James Clarence Mangan. Yet the more I read of Mangan, the more fascinated I am by him, the more unwilling I am to put him in a minor box, eccentric, strange, maddening, though his poetry can be. And I remind myself that he mattered a lot to James Joyce. So perhaps one does start to rewrite the histories.
But major and minor, of course, mean something quite different. The major poet, in classical terms, as Michael Hambury used to remind us when people said Peter Huckel is not a major poet, he said a major poet is a poet who writes his eclogues, writes his georgics, and writes his epic. And we don't have the genre anymore, and therefore you cannot be a major poet unless you are performing the genre. I mean, it is an old category. But, I mean, to be a very, very good poet like Yeats, or to be a very, very good poet like Pound, Pound has performed it, of course, in the genre. is sufficient. I do think your point about qualitative discrimination is terribly important. I mean, you know, there are good poems, there are bad poems, there are great poems, there are minor poems. And your fisherman, or Yeats's fisherman rather, is not ever going to go to Byzantium, it seems to me, though he may go with some of the shuddering ladies that you'll be speaking about in your lecture.
Yes. You see, just to take us back a little to where you began, Michael, with this question of poetry and rhetoric, it more and more seems to me that Yeats does not really buy into a distinction between poetry and rhetoric. He will bring it out from time to time for particular purposes. But when W.B. Yeats is composing a poem, all the energies, good and bad, of rhetoric are fighting with all the energies, easy and difficult, of his poetic imagination. Everything's engaged, including, by the way, the question of gender. That's why I think it's fascinating that he does write that poem on woman at more or less the time he's making the poetry-rhetoric distinction. And my reading of On Woman, for example, is that the feminine, as he brands it, comes out better in the wash there. It is men and the hidebound masculine intellectual rhetoric. That's what's in trouble in that poem, I think.
But they're not Solomon and they're not writing the poems. I have some problems. It reminds me of a distinction that used to be popular when Yeats was writing people must be don't talk out anymore, it was used to be men as becoming and women as being, and there's something of that there, isn't there?
Of course Yeats became almost desperate to produce major women poets, and his Oxford Book of Modern Verse is, we need to remember or remind ourselves, a very, very aggressive act of anthologizing, which utterly foregrounds women poets
and misses many of the good ones.
Well, misses many good poets along the way. There's no doubt about that.
Is it the case that Yeats did occasionally line up the rhyme words and write into the rhymes when he was writing? In other words, was he would set himself almost this crossword puzzle kind of challenge, which shows what a great rhetorician he is, which doesn't necessarily militate against the truth of the poem, but
I think if you do look at all the manuscripts of Yeats, that happens relatively rarely. He is much more liable, especially from the 20s onwards, to write a prose framework, will then become a poem. But the prose framework is never merely versified. Indeed, the poem can end up going quite against where the prose framework began.
Should we go listen to your prose framework and listen to your lecture? It's almost time.
It is almost time, and so, thank you for your...
Well, thank you very much for hospitality, and thank you very much, William, for...
Thank you.
Checking in.